we are moving from donations to dirt, which is something that Seattle moved a lot of in the early 20th century. If you look around the city landscape, you will see some massive changes from those early days. We dug the Ship Canal. We created new land by filling in the tide flats, and we cut off the top of Denny Hill, which created the Belltown neighborhood of today. If you think about the scale of those projects, it makes the so-called mega projects of today, like digging the waterfront tunnel, seem pretty small by comparison. Geology writer David Williams told Ross Reynolds about the earth-shaking ambitions of Seattle's forefathers.
It's sort of amazing. I mean, they came here in one way with this great ambition. They were going to make Seattle succeed. And they knew that the only way they were going to succeed initially was to be able to go out to sea, to have a sailing mechanism. So the main thing they were looking for initially was a good port. They didn't really look at the land, but they were so driven and so determined to succeed that they knew that they could alter the land and make it work. And it's sort of amazing to think about. If we start in 1895, that's when the official filling of the tide flats begins, and they start sucking up mud from one part of the tide flat and dumping it behind a barrier and start filling in that landscape. So over a period of about 20 years, they create about 2,200 acres of new land. So all of the property between West Seattle and Beacon Hill that the Soto neighborhood sits on, all of that is made during that time period. At the same time, you also have the building of the Ship Canal, so 1916 to 1917, and you have that complete alteration of the landscape and the re-plumbing of Lake Washington. And then you also have major regrades going on. You have the Denny regrade, which is a multiple-year, multi-regrade project. And then you also have the regrade of Jackson Street, which is basically the International District, and the regrade of Dearborn Street. So all of these incredibly huge projects in 35 years.
What's it say about the character of early Seattleites and early Seattle?
They were crazy. I mean, it's ambitious. It's sort of foolish in a way. It's what has come down to be called the Seattle spirit, that they would do whatever necessary to make Seattle succeed. And it was part, I think, ambition. It was part naivete that they could do all this stuff. It was part insecurity. I think Seattle has always had this dream of being a world-class city. And so we've always been a little bit insecure. And I think this just was the beginning of that phase of, oh, we can do it. We're a tough little city. We can, you know, make it succeed. I mean, the best is in May of 1874, Seattle loses out on the Transcontinental Railroad. And everybody in town, roughly 900 of the 1,000 people in town, gather south of town to start building our own railroad. We're only going to Walla Walla. We are going to succeed, and we are going to make it happen.
Yeah, it's like the spirit of rebuilding the city after the fire also.
Exactly.
Did it go smoothly? I mean, were there Bertha-breaking like moments in the course of doing all these big projects?
Yeah, good question. With the filling in of the tide flats, the slowdowns were primarily due to lawsuits, as people suing and saying, we don't want you to do this, we don't want you to do this. That's one aspect of it. The other aspect that started on the land or the tide flats was this idea that they were going to build a south canal. So we think of our modern canal where it cuts through at the north end of town. Historically, the goal was to build a canal through Beacon Hill that was going to be 300 feet deep, and they started work on it. And the powers that be in the north stopped it. And we can still see the effects of that. If you're going along the Spokane Street Bridge and you take the Columbia Street on-ramps up to Beacon Hill, those go right through the cut. That's where the canal historically would have been. With the regrades, the issues were more variety of people died. The hillsides would collapse in. But I always sort of joke that they had a totally different worldview. They were shooting the hill, washing the hills away with water. And what they would do is if they hit a lens that was hard or something was in the way, they just throw a couple sticks of dynamite, blow it up, and keep moving. So their issues were different but similar, and it was just like, oh, well, just toss some dynamite in.
We're listening to geology writer David Williams. His new book is called Too High and Too Steep. And the cover of this has what to me is one of the iconic photos of Seattle's change, and it shows what happened when they regraded this Denny Hill. They sluiced it down into the water, but some of the landowners didn't sell right away. So they're on these, it looks like it's from science fiction or something, these buildings on top of these high towers.
Yeah, absolutely. It is the iconic image shot by Asahel Curtis in May of 1910. And you're absolutely right that the mounds that are left are privately owned. And the story has always been that they're called spite mounds, is that the people who own them didn't believe in Denny Hill and that they wanted to keep that land themselves. But we know that two of the mounds in the picture were actually owned by a man named James Kelly, who had come to Seattle early in the 1890s, gone to Klondike, made his money, and then was actually up in Alaska when they start doing this regrade between 1908 and 1910. And in essence, he didn't have the paperwork. He comes back to town in December of 1910, immediately signs the paperwork, and the mounds are gone within a couple of months. So it's a snapshot of time that has given us this impression, but it was really the fact that the guy was out of town and couldn't sign the paperwork to make it happen.
In 2015, our mega projects are rebuilding the seawall, are tunneling through the underneath the city, or maybe rebuilding a bridge here and there. How do you see these kinds of mega projects, as they're called, come after writing this book and researching the mega projects of the past?
I'll go in the past a little bit, because I think these early projects in the city were so successful, it sort of made this part of the DNA of the city, that when we have to deal with topography, we are going to manipulate the landscape. We have to figure out how to move through this very challenging landscape of Seattle. And so the modern projects continue that. But the big difference is that the early people came to Seattle with this vision of changing the landscape. We now worry and know that the landscape's going to change us. So part of the reason we're obviously building the State Route 99 tunnel is we're concerned from a seismic point of view the viaduct's going to collapse. And part of the reason we're building the seawall is because we understand seismically. But we also have to worry about climate change. So we're still trying to deal with this landscape, but we recognize so much more how problematic it is and how potentially dangerous the landscape is.
Geology writer David Williams' book is called Too High and Too Steep. He talked with Ross Reynolds.